In 2017, there was a public debate. The question at hand was whether or not there truly had been an advanced global civilization that was destroyed at the end of the last ice age. Of course, there was only one medium capable of hosting such a sprawling and weirdly specific conversation. And that was, of course, a podcast. Nothing does sprawling and weirdly specific quite like a podcast. But the debate didn't happen on just any podcast. It took place on one of the internet's most popular shows, The Joe Rogan Experience. As many of you know, the comedian, MMA commentator, and former Fear Factor host, Joe Rogan, hosts a hugely popular show where he does everything from interview celebrities, discuss ultimate fighting, and muse about the various benefits of cannabis. If you're one of the few people out there that doesn't know the Joe Rogan show, then you might know it as the show where Elon Musk smoked a joint. Anyway, Joe prides himself on being an open-minded guy. And as such, he doesn't mind giving a platform to some controversial thinkers. Graham Hancock, for instance, was someone who had been on Rogan's podcast a number of times discussing his lost civilization hypothesis. What made the podcast, released on May 16th, 2017, a little different was that on this show, Hancock and amateur geologist Randall Carlson were going to be debated by Michael Shermer. Shermer is the founder of the Skeptics Society and editor-in-chief of the magazine Skeptic. If his resume isn't enough of a clue, Michael Shermer is a professional skeptic who makes a living publicly challenging the claims of those outside the scientific mainstream. Now, if you're curious about the debate, then please go check it out. If you don't normally listen to the Joe Rogan Experience, it can be easily found on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. But I'm not sure if I recommend this particular debate. It's 3 hours long, everyone gets very defensive, and no one comes out looking particularly good. In my opinion, Hancock reveals himself to be a real takes-it-personal, makes-it-personal kind of guy. For his part, Shermer starts out reasonably enough, but is very quickly swamped by his opponents. It can be hard to listen to. Anyway, there was one moment from early on in the debate that I found particularly interesting, because I think it illustrates how Graham Hancock's arguments tend to function. Here's a clip. It starts with Shermer posing a fairly pointed question to Hancock about his interpretation of Göbekli Tepe. And remember, Göbekli Tepe was that ancient archaeological site that we spoke about in part one of this series. Let's take a listen to the clip.
Yeah, all right. So my final point is the falsifiability one. That is, what would it take to refute your hypothesis? Like, for me, the answer would be, like, if Göbekli Tepe turned out to be what you think it might have been, the place where advanced ancient civilization once inhabited or they used it, where are the metal tools? Where are the writing, the examples of writing?
Perhaps a decision was made not to use metal. Perhaps a decision was made that errors had taken place, that in reinventing civilization, we shouldn't perhaps go down quite the same route as before. Perhaps writing isn't always an advance. Perhaps an oral tradition which records in memory, which enhances and uses the power of memory, may be a very effective way of dealing with information. We regard writing as an advance, and I can see lots of reasons why it is an advance, but if we put ourselves into the heads of ancient peoples, maybe it wasn't. I mean, there's a tradition from ancient Egypt that the god Thoth, god of wisdom, was the inventor of writing, but we have a text in which he is questioned by a pharaoh who is saying, well, actually, have you really done a good thing by introducing writing? Because then the words may roam around the world without wise advice to put them into into context and what will happen to memory when people... So there might be a choice not to go that way.
All right, but then what do you mean by advance? When you say there used to be a lost advanced civilization before 10,000 years ago...
Well, let's just pause here for a second.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, we should pause there. Now, as you might have guessed, the gentleman with the English accent is Graham Hancock. I pulled this clip because... Hancock's answer to that particular question is indicative of a strategy he uses throughout Magicians of the Gods. Shermer asks him a pretty straightforward question. If an advanced civilization helped the builders of Göbekli Tepe, then why don't we see clear evidence of them in the archaeological record? Where are the metal tools? Where is the writing? Hancock responds with some serious speculation. He says, perhaps, a number of times there. He says, maybe the refugees from his lost civilization purposefully didn't use metal tools or writing because they were trying to right the wrongs of their first stab at civilization. He then buttresses this idea by pointing to an Egyptian myth where a god is chastised for teaching people the secret of writing. Before you know it, you're knee-deep in a complex tale about the Egyptian god Thoth. The effect is a little disorienting. Hancock sounds so sure, and his knowledge seems so deep and specific. You start thinking, well, maybe this guy has a point. But... let's look a little closer at that logic. All the material evidence at Göbekli Tepe suggests that it was built by hunters and gatherers. The best guess then should be that it was them who built it. Hancock is saying that they didn't, and to explain the lack of evidence for his claim, he concocts a story that can't really be proven or disproven. There's no material evidence of his lost culture because they'd simply chosen not to use the kind of things that would leave material evidence. How does he know this? Well, he doesn't. However, there is a myth from Egypt where a god is told to hold off on disseminating technology, so that proves it? This is a huge stretch. Hancock is asking us not to look at the evidence and draw conclusions, but instead to look at a lack of evidence and fill in the blanks with him. I mean, doesn't it seem kind of convenient that his lost culture just decided not to preserve any of their material culture? I mean, that seems kind of odd to me. Still, the style of his argumentation is such that you really have to stop and consider his propositions very carefully. Very quickly, you find yourself trying to unravel a riddle about the god Thoth or some other obscure tidbit, and you've lost sight of how bold some of Hancock's assertions truly are. I mean, forgive me for editorializing here, but that exchange we just heard could maybe be paraphrased as, "Hey, Graham, why didn't your ancient civilization leave any trace of itself?" And he just says, "Well, they didn't feel like it." Take out the tangential connection to the god Thoth, and that's not a very satisfying answer. But I promised that I would give the hypotheses of Graham Hancock a fair hearing, and by gum, I'm going to try. I may have not found Hancock's appearance on Joe Rogan very compelling, but what about the contents of his book? Is there anything in Magicians of the Gods that can convince me that perhaps there was an advanced civilization thousands of years older than any other on Earth that was wiped out by a global cataclysm and went on to plant the seeds of knowledge around the world? Well, let's find out today on Our Fake History.
Hey,
episode number 79, Who Were the Magicians of the Gods, part 2. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. Today, we are finishing our examination of Magicians of the Gods, Graham Hancock's 2015 book that makes the case for a super ancient lost civilization that spanned the globe. This is part two of a two-part series on this topic. So if you haven't heard part one, then you may want to go back and give that a listen now. In that first part, I spent quite a bit of time setting up who Graham Hancock is and explaining my own spotty history with his various theories. I also spent a good portion of the episode explaining the significance of an archaeological site known as Göbekli Tepe. And yes, it is pronounced Göbekli Tepe and not Göbekli Tepe, which apparently I said a couple times. So Göbekli Tepe. As we learned, Göbekli Tepe is a truly remarkable site in southern Turkey that is home to the oldest known examples of megalithic architecture. The massive structures found there date to roughly 9,600 BC, which makes them about 5,000 years older than the next oldest examples of this type of building. It's an amazing discovery that has completely reshaped what we think of Stone Age society and the capabilities of hunters and gatherers. Of course, if you were to ask Graham Hancock, this simply could not be the work of hunter-gatherers alone. Instead, he proposes that refugees from an advanced lost civilization brought their sophisticated architectural techniques to these more primitive cultures and taught them how to build Göbekli Tepe and other impressive structures. Now, lately, I've started to get surprised by the reach of our humble little podcast. I know there are a lot of you out there listening, but making this show is such a solitary endeavor that it's easy to forget that. But after I released the last show, it turns out a real-life, honest-to-goodness archaeologist heard the episode, and then he reached out to me. His name is Jens Notroff. He's a German archaeologist, an expert in the hunter-gatherer sites of southern Turkey, and a colleague of the late Klaus Schmidt, the man who is credited with discovering Göbekli Tepe. A little Googling and I realized that Jens is one of the world's leading experts on the site that I had prattled on about for nearly an hour the week before. Now, I thought this was the coolest thing ever. It's so rare when we get to hear from someone who's so close to the subject matter we're discussing. I tried to get Jens to come on the show, but his schedule was far too crammed to do it over the last couple weeks. Nevertheless, there were some pretty interesting things that came out of our Twitter exchange. First of all, I was humbled that he liked the show and thought we'd done a fair job of examining some of the claims about Göbekli Tepe. He also wanted to make a few clarifications, and I am not going to stop him. Off the top, he pointed to the fact that I said that only 5% of Göbekli Tepe had been excavated. This number appears in most of the popular articles about the site, but as an archaeologist that's actually working in the region, he knows at this moment considerably more of Göbekli Tepe has been excavated. I'm going to quote from his tweet here. He tells us, quote, "After about 20 years of excavation, a bit more is exposed now. Of course, without knowing how big a site it is, it's hard to give exact numbers of what is uncovered. But it's more than 5%. That said, it's a rule in archaeology to not excavate everything. Since excavation means destruction of context, hence the detailed documentation, We aim to only excavate as much as necessary to understand the site, but preserve as much as possible, too, by leaving it untouched. End quote. I'm really glad that Jens made that point. The goal of archaeology isn't to reveal absolutely everything, because, as he puts it, excavation destroys context. So there will not come a day in the future where 100% of Göbekli Tepe is uncovered and hence all the mysteries are revealed. The next and most important point he made had to do with the wiggle room I gave to Hancock in the last episode. In my quest to be fair, I gave Hancock credit for pointing out something that I too found mysterious. This was that the oldest parts of Göbekli Tepe appear to be the most artistically sophisticated, and there doesn't seem to be much evidence of an evolution of technique. I also mentioned that a decline in artistic sophistication appears to have taken place over the centuries at that site. This was something that was both emphasized by Hancock and was pointed out in the National Geographic feature on the site. Here's what Jens said to that. Quote, "Actually, there is not really an artistic or technological decline visible. The older monuments are larger, but that doesn't mean the younger, smaller pillars represent a loss of knowledge or technique, but a change in necessities. With new subsistence strategies in the Neolithic, group size and social structures, and finally, social activities related to these monuments changed. There was a rise of a new way of living, the Neolithic way of living, our way of living. About that quote-unquote pristine sudden appearance that the cultural achievements of Göbekli Tepe seem to represent, the older hunter tradition is visible all over the place in the tools and weapon types, animal reigns, iconography. Yes, we don't know yet if there were predecessing structures, maybe even made of wood, thus not preserved. Carving techniques and finds like the Shigar idol of similar age, but not directly related to the GT monuments, suggests at least the possibility." End quote. So, there you have it. According to one of the world's leading experts, the so-called artistic decline coincides with a massive new development in technology, namely the creation of agriculture. Jens Nordtroff sees changing priorities at Göbekli Tepe as opposed to an artistic forgetfulness. He also proposes that carving techniques like those found at Göbekli Tepe are also evidenced in the super old wood carvings that have also been found around the world, like the famous Russian artifact known as the Shigar idol. Super interesting stuff. I wanted to leave the door open a crack for Hancock's theories, but Jens very rightly closed it shut. I was really happy that he reached out, and I was humbled by his kind words about the show. So, Jens, if you're out there listening, you are always welcome on Our Fake History, and hopefully we get a chance to talk to you soon. Okay, now that we've addressed all that, there is still lots to unpack for Magicians of the Gods. This is no small task. One of Graham Hancock's techniques is to cram his books full of information. It isn't wild speculation that pads out the pages of Magicians. Instead, Hancock spends huge amounts of time educating his reader about largely uncontroversial bits of geology and history. He quotes at length from ancient myth. He explains the movements of ancient glacial ice sheets, and he lays out largely uncontested facts about ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, and southern Turkey. This has a way of lending his more extravagant moments a certain weight. He's building a case. There's so much information to sort through in his book that the sheer weight of it can seem persuasive. The feeling you get is, how can someone with so much evidence be wrong? But here's the thing. It's not all evidence. Or at least, it isn't evidence of his biggest, most audacious claims. It is certainly data, but the question is, does that data add up to there being a super advanced global civilization that existed during the last ice age? Well, there is no way in the context of this humble podcast that I can evaluate every single claim that Hancock makes in his massive book. So I'm going to restrict myself to two main things. First, I'm going to look at the geological theory that Hancock relies on to explain the sudden disappearance of his lost civilization. Secondly, I want to return to Göbekli Tepe and look at how Hancock's interpretation of the artwork found there stands up to scrutiny. Okay, let's see what we can find out. Chapter 3 of Magicians of the Gods starts with Hancock quoting from an Ojibwe legend, as recorded by the anthropologist Thor Conway. He writes, quote, "The star with the long, wide tail is going to destroy the world someday when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. It came down here once, thousands of years ago. Just like the sun, it had radiation and burning heat in its tail. Things were wrong with nature on the Earth. Then that comet went through here. It burned up everything. It flew so low that the tail scorched the Earth. The comet made a different world. After that, survival was hard work. The weather was colder than before." End quote. This myth is meant to introduce the idea of a comet impact greatly changing the Earth and bringing on a period of cooling many thousands of years in the past. This sets up a key piece of Hancock's hypothesis, and that is a geological theory known as the Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis. If you remember from the last episode, the Younger Dryas is a geological period that occurred right at the boundary between the Pleistocene and Holocene geologic eras. At the end of the Pleistocene, the world was getting warmer, but then suddenly it got super cold again for like 1300 years, only to warm up just as suddenly at the dawn of the Holocene. For Graham Hancock, this rapid climate change is exactly the kind of destabilizing global event that could have wiped away a sophisticated urban civilization. To help further this hypothesis, Hancock has embraced a controversial geological theory that involves a comet breaking up in the atmosphere and hitting the Laurentide ice sheet, the massive glacier that covered a huge chunk of North America at the end of the last ice age. This impact, if it happened, could explain why the Younger Dryas occurred. A comet impact, or more precisely a series of impacts, could have led to a sudden melting of huge quantities of ice. This sudden flood of cold water into the oceans could have disrupted warm ocean currents, plunging the world into a period of cooling. This dramatic event could also explain why there seems to have been a sudden period of forest fires, or biomass burning, in the period directly preceding the Younger Dryas. The comet impact might also help explain the sudden disappearance of something called the Clovis culture in the archaeological record. The Clovis culture were a group of ancient indigenous North Americans who existed around the end of the last ice age and who hunted mastodons and other super cool megafauna. Honestly, the Clovis culture are total badasses, hunting giant beasts and all. You go, Clovis culture. We know about them because we found their artifacts, which are mainly stone spear points that are carved in a distinctive way. Around the onset of the Younger Dryas, these artifacts suddenly vanish, leaving many to wonder what exactly happened to the Clovis culture. If you go in for the comet impact theory, then they were suddenly wiped out by both the immediate warming and fiery destruction associated with the impact, and then the subsequent cooling trend that followed. In Hancock's estimation, the same thing that wiped out the Clovis culture also wiped out his lost civilization. Now, this is one of the biggest changes in Hancock's hypothesis since Fingerprints of the Gods, his 1995 book. In that book, he speculated that the catastrophe that wiped out his lost civilization was caused by something called Earth crust displacement. This theory has been so thoroughly dismantled that Hancock barely even mentions its name in Magicians of the Gods. Now his wagon is thoroughly hitched to the Younger Dryas impact theory. So the question is this theory legit? Well, the answer to that question is somewhat complicated. Whereas Earth crust displacement was never really accepted by the geological mainstream, the Younger Dryas impact theory is among the discipline's most hotly debated hypotheses. It was first developed by the geologists R.B. Firestone, Alan West, and Simon Warwick Smith in their 2006 book, The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes: How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. A year later, there was also an academic article that appeared in the journal The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that presented Firestone and his colleagues' research. They claimed that they had recorded the existence of a huge abundance of impact markers, the geological remains of a comet impact. According to the study, many of these impact markers were found in the layers of Earth directly on top of Clovis culture archaeological sites. They claimed at multiple sites you see Clovis artifacts at one layer of soil, and then just above it you get an organically rich layer of soil called a black mat. In these boundary layers, they claim to have found special magnetically charged little spheres, sometimes called nanodiamonds, that could only have been created by a comet impact. Firestone and company's work caused quite a stir in the geological community, as it challenged previously held ideas about the Younger Dryas. The prevailing theory had been that it hadn't been one massive melting event that changed the climate, but rather a series of glacial melts that had steadily made the ocean colder, eventually tipping the climate into a cooling trend. Now, there is nothing wrong with Firestone's theory on the face of it. The issue came when other geologists tried to confirm the findings with their own investigations. When they did that, they simply did not find the same kind of compelling geological evidence described by Firestone and West. In a paper published in the same journal that had originally published Firestone's work, a group of geologists, including Vance Holliday and Todd Surreville, challenged the Younger Dryas impact theory on the grounds that the science could not be reproduced. The abstract for that paper damningly stated, quote, "We were unable to reproduce any results of the Firestone et al. Study and find no support for the Younger Dryas extraterrestrial impact," end quote. Well, that casts some serious doubt on the original hypothesis. Now, Hancock presents the pushback that Firestone and his crew received as typical of a geological establishment who hate new ideas, specifically anything that could be labeled catastrophism. You see, a huge part of part two of Magicians of the Gods is taken up by the story of a certain geologist named Jay Betts. Now, without getting too off track here, here's what you need to know about this. Jay Betts was a geologist with a somewhat radical theory about how a particular feature of Washington State was created. The mainstream resisted him, the mainstream even hated his ideas, and then eventually Betts was able to convince them with more and more evidence. Now, why does Hancock tell us this story? Well, part of it is to reinforce the idea that sometimes geological ideas change. And another is to reinforce a second idea that the geological community hates this change. Also, if I can editorialize again for a second, I get the feeling that Hancock wants his reader to think of him as Jay Betts, a man with a radical hypothesis rejected by the mainstream only to one day be proven right. I don't know. That was just the vibe I was getting. But here's the thing. Even if Betts and others were resisted in their own time, that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's happening right now with the Younger Dryas impact theory. In fact, one of the theory's most vocal critics is a man named Mark Boslow, a physicist from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He was originally intrigued by Firestone's hypothesis. He told Science News, quote, "I thought they were onto something." But when his own independent analysis did not confirm the findings of Firestone, he became understandably skeptical. Boslow also found it odd that there were not identifiable craters left behind from the comet impact. Science News explains it like this, quote, "Boslow says he took issue with the physics of the proposed impact mechanisms, which have ranged from a single object striking the ice sheet to multiple fragments exploding in the atmosphere. But none of the scenarios make sense," Boslow says. "Either the pieces of a fragmented comet would have been too small to generate much energy, or they would have been too large not to leave a crater." End quote. I bring up Boslow because I think it throws some cold water on the idea that there's some academic conspiracy against the comet. In this case, anyway, it seems like the theory is being resisted because the findings can't be independently confirmed. Not because people hate the idea of comets hitting the Earth. But the debate around the Younger Dryas impact theory is far from over. Boslow was concerned about the lack of a crater. Well, in 2013, there was a crater identified in Quebec that some think was created by our mini Ice Age comet. But then, of course, those findings have also been challenged. So, I think the best we can say, as of this recording, is that the Younger Dryas impact theory is a plausible theory that has still yet to gain mainstream acceptance because of some serious problems with the scientific evidence. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a fringe theory because it is being proposed by proper geologists and it is being debated in the pages of a usually reasonable academic journal. This rigorous back and forth is how science is supposed to work. Who knows? In a few years, the burden of evidence may become so great that we all accept that a comet strike started the Younger Dryas. But honestly, we're not there yet. There are still some serious reasons to doubt it. Now, I would say this is not a very stable foundation on which to build a hypothesis. But for Graham Hancock, because there's an Ojibwe myth that also speaks of a destructive comet, well, that basically seals it. The comet is real. Mark that as a point for the long-lost civilization. Now, to be fair, Hancock is careful not to jump directly to his conclusion. He does not claim that a comet causing the Younger Dryas means that there was a lost advanced civilization. But he does use the impact to help him fill in some blanks in his theory. He also comes back to his comet when he returns to Göbekli Tepe to make his final analysis of the site. So let's return to Göbekli Tepe and evaluate one of his most incredible claims about the nature of the site. Part 6 of Magicians of the Gods, Graham Hancock turns his attention back to Göbekli Tepe, and he makes one of his most bold claims about the site. In the back half of his book, Hancock finally deploys the argument that he has spent chapters carefully setting up. That is, that Göbekli Tepe is a cosmic decoder ring that makes the rest of his theory make sense. At this site, there are a series of symbols that, if read correctly, tell of both an ancient cataclysm, a group of wisdom-bearing sages, and a future cataclysm coming in our own time. The most important piece of this Göbekli Tepe decoder ring, as I like to call it, is a particularly fascinating T-shaped pillar found in a part of the site known as Enclosure D. This is easily the most famous of all the giant pillars at the site. In archaeological circles, it's known simply as Pillar 43, but fans of the site have dubbed it the Vulture Stone. Now, I'm going to post a picture of Pillar 43 on the page on the website for this episode, and it will also be up on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/ourfakehistory. My artist, Frank, actually made Pillar 43 the centerpiece of today's episode art, and honestly, I think he made it look pretty cool, so check that out. So, last episode, I mentioned that many of the pillars at Göbekli Tepe have animals carved in relief. Well, the Vulture Stone is one of them. In fact, it's a particularly busy column that features a number of animal images. At the base of the column, there's an image that looks like a large scorpion. Above that, there's an image that looks like a vulture with an outstretched wing. Perched just above that wing is a mysterious sphere. Then, to the right of the vulture, are two other bird-like carvings. Hancock uses Pillar 43 in a number of different ways when making his argument. To keep going with my analogy, the decoder ring has a number of different settings. Firstly, he sees the image of the vulture as a symbol that's meant to represent, oh, here it comes, super advanced magician refugees from a lost civilization. Okay, so obviously he doesn't jump right to that, so here's how he gets there. When Hancock looks at this particular vulture carving, he sees something part human. He introduces this idea way back in part one of the book, where he writes this description of the carving. Quote, "Another human characteristic of the vulture, quite dissimilar to any example of this bird that I have ever seen in nature, is that it is portrayed with its quote-unquote knees bent forward, with strangely elongated flat feet, a bit like some of the cartoon representations of the Penguin character in the old Batman comics. It is, in other words, a therianthrope, from the Greek therion, meaning wild beast, and anthropos, meaning man, a hybrid creature, part human and part vulture. End quote. Okay. Already, he's made a pretty big leap. I encourage you all to look at the image of the vulture and see if you can find the knees. I think it's a stretch to assume that this was meant to represent a human-animal hybrid. Sure, I mean, it's possible, I guess, but it's hardly the foregone conclusion that he presents it as here. The next leap he makes is even more bold. He suggests that maybe that human-bird hybrid is an echo of something that comes from the ancient Jewish religious text known as the Book of Enoch. This book, written around 300 BC, is holy in Judaism, but is considered outside of the canon by most Christian groups. It's part of what we call the Apocrypha. Now, this is about to get pretty weird, so bear with me. You see, Hancock suggests that the refugees from his lost society were spoken about in ancient mythology, although in those myths, they were taken for gods. He identifies the seven sages in Egyptian mythology as his refugees. He also believes that a group of semi-divine wise men from Mesopotamian myth, known as the seven Apkallu, were also meant to represent his refugees. In Hancock's introduction to writer Andrew Collins' book on Göbekli Tepe, he tells us about a group called the Watchers from the Book of Enoch. Hancock writes, quote, "A deep look at the description of the Watchers in ancient Jewish texts, such as the Book of Enoch, makes it clear that these mythical creatures were not incorporeal angels, but were flesh and blood human beings with very distinct shamanistic qualities. They are occasionally said to wear dark iridescent cloaks or feather cloaks, and on occasion take flight like birds, echoing the presence of a Near East cult of death and rebirth centered around the vulture." End quote. A paragraph later, he asks, "Did the Watchers really introduce this current world age to forbidden knowledge carried over from a global civilization that once thrived in an antediluvian world?" End quote. And for those of you that don't know, antediluvian means before the flood. Anyway, so there's a lot to unpack here. To get to magicians building Göbekli Tepe, here are the steps Hancock takes. First, he zeroes in on these watchers from a pretty obscure old Jewish text. Then he focuses on one particular description of them, namely that they were bird-like. Now, even he notes that they were only occasionally described that way. But no matter, that's the description he's interested in. Next, he takes another big leap and suggests that the bird-like descriptions of the Watchers echo the ancient Near East cult that used vulture symbols. I think you see where he's going with this. Vulture symbols are a shout-out to the Watchers, who were shamanistic flesh-and-blood humans who seemed divine. The vulture at Göbekli Tepe suggests that the people who inspired the Watcher stories were also the people who built Göbekli Tepe. Okay, so this is bonkers, right? This is the kind of loose, free association kind of logic that drives me crazy. Just because the Watchers were occasionally described as wearing feather cloaks and flying doesn't make them vultures. it sure as heck doesn't mean that they are connected at all to other bird imagery from the Near East, let alone the vulture cult. The story of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch and the site of Göbekli Tepe don't really have a clear connection. To get there, you have to do this pretty ridiculous connect the dots. Now, to be fair, Hancock saves that more fast and loose speculation for the introductions of other people's books. In Magicians, he's a little more careful. While he does spend pages unpacking descriptions of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch, he's more interested in the image of the vulture on Pillar 43 as an example of super ancient astronomy. In other words, that vulture's got more than one meaning. Okay, is everyone ready to set their decoder ring to a new setting? Let's do it now. Hancock tells us, quote, Göbekli Tepe is a profoundly astronomical site, that its builders observed the stars closely, and that they were able to manifest these observations very successfully in the alignments of the structures on the ground. End quote. This is one of his big proofs for the existence of magicians guiding the creation of Göbekli Tepe. He tells us that whoever built Göbekli Tepe had a serious knowledge of the stars and may have even been trying to send a message deep into the future using the symbolic language of astrology. This, according to Hancock, could not have been done by hunter-gatherers, but was rather the calling card of his magicians from a lost civilization. Building on the theories of others, Hancock suggests that the scorpion at the base of Pillar 43 is meant to represent the constellation Scorpius. From there, keeping in mind that the skies would have appeared differently to us 11,600 years ago, he goes on to match all the other images on the Vulture Stone to other constellations. He particularly leans into an assertion from a researcher named Paul Burley that the vulture figure lines up nicely with the constellation Sagittarius. According to Hancock, the way that these symbols are arranged on the stone accurately depict how the constellations would have appeared in the sky many millennia ago. That strange sphere above the vulture's wing? In this scheme, that represents the sun at the center of the sky during the December solstice. If we use that as our guide, then we can orient how all the other images on Pillar 43 fit in with constellations. What is the significance of all this? Hancock proposes that the night sky being depicted on this pillar is exactly the one that would have existed in 10,950 BC, exactly around the time the Younger Dryas comet, if it existed, would have hit the Earth. So, this pillar is a star map of the exact moment when his Atlantis-like civilization was destroyed, carved 1,000 years after the fact. He then gets even more bold and suggests that the builders of Göbekli Tepe knew so much about the precession of the stars that this should be read as a warning. A warning for who? A warning for us, the people living between the years of 2000 and 2040 AD. You see, the night sky depicted in 10,950 BC also aligns perfectly with the night sky right now, apparently. Hancock buttons this all up by proposing that we are once again in the same cosmic alignment as we were when the Younger Dryas comet struck. This cosmic alignment puts us close to a particular meteor stream that he thinks was the source of that original Younger Dryas comet. Therefore, we are in imminent danger of another comet strike in the next few years. And Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe was designed specifically to warn us right now of that fact. Did you get all that? Oh, man. How do we even start to unpack this? Okay, well, first, the stretches of logic here are, once again, pretty mind-boggling. I think Mark J. DeFont made a very good point in his 2017 Skeptic magazine feature challenging Hancock's claims in Magicians of the Gods. Now, I'm going to quote from this, and just a note here, I changed a word to constellation because the word he used was less known. So when you hear the word constellation, just know that that's my addition. DeFont asked, quote, "If you wanted to convey the existence of a comet strike to future generations, would it not be prudent and obvious to carve the actual positions of the stars along with the comet on a rock?" End quote. He then continues, quote, "So why don't these ancients show off their knowledge with star maps rather than with figures that may or may not represent constellations? I think the answer is obvious. The carvings likely have nothing to do with constellations." End quote. I think that is a very good point. DeFont also accuses Hancock of something we call patternicity. That is, finding patterns where one does not necessarily exist. For Hancock's constellations to work, then you have to accept that that sphere-looking thing on the pillar is the sun during the December solstice. And that's a big jump right off the hop. Next, you have to accept that the other figures align nicely with common constellations in the sky. DeFont and many others have pointed out that it's a real stretch to suggest that the constellation Sagittarius lines up well with that vulture carving. I'll put up a picture of it and you can decide for yourselves, but I mean, I guess it kind of fits, but it could kind of fit with a lot of things. Finally, it's a huge jump to even suggest that the animals on the pillar are meant to represent constellations at all. There is no evidence that hunter-gatherers used what would become the accepted zodiac. Klaus Schmidt told Hancock to his face that the zodiac wasn't invented until thousands of years later by the Babylonians. While there is some research that suggests that the zodiac could have potentially predated the Babylonians, there is really no evidence that the hunter-gatherer societies of 9,600 BC were using it. In other words, there's no evidence that they connected scorpions with the constellation that much later cultures would call Scorpius. Finally, all of the real experts on Göbekli Tepe, I'm talking the late Klaus Schmidt and my new best friend, Jens Nordtruff, they are all adamant that Göbekli Tepe was not designed with astronomy or astrology in mind. While they believe that the site most certainly had ritual significance, they found no compelling proof that Pillar 43 or any other pillar was meant as a star map. On top of that, these archaeologists completely reject the idea that the builders of Göbekli Tepe had knowledge of the zodiac and incorporated zodiac symbols into their design. Okay, so let's take a breath. That was some tough slogging through some pretty heavy BS. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, I'll give you my final thoughts on Graham Hancock and Magicians of the Gods.
Thank you.
So here's the question. After wading through nearly 400 pages of Magicians of the Gods, am I any more convinced that there may have been a super advanced lost civilization? Well, let's break it down. First, I think Hancock was wise to abandon Earth crust displacement and instead focus on the Younger Dryas comet as his cataclysm. The onset of the mini ice age known as the Younger Dryas is a legitimate geological mystery. Even mainstream geologists admit that it hasn't been entirely explained. The comet impact theory doesn't seem that far-fetched, but it is far from proven. Geologists are still having it out about this one. At this time, there are some very serious reasons to doubt the comet impact theory. But who knows? Maybe in a few years there will be enough evidence that the geological community will accept it as a fact. I am open to this. I just don't think we're there yet. So I will give Hancock this. There might have been a comet, and that's a big might. But there might have been a comet that hit the Laurentide ice sheet and caused sudden cataclysmic flooding that could have destroyed a civilization. If there was one. I will also concede that Göbekli Tepe is a pretty astounding sight. It has legitimately changed our understanding of the distant past. Despite the excellent work that's been done by archaeologists, there is still much we do not understand about this site. Now, I am convinced by the evidence that it was a hunter-gatherer society that built the massive structures at Göbekli Tepe. Still, I'll admit there's much to be learned. The art and architecture there is so impressive, and the site is just so old that I think it's reasonable to wonder about the details of its construction. I will also allow that sometimes myths do in fact contain grains of historical truth. Heck, that's essentially the thesis statement of this entire podcast series. How many times have I demonstrated that something that was thought of as purely legendary often had a parallel in real history? In short, I'm okay with the fact that Hancock uses myth. But friends, that's as much as I'm going to give Hancock. I find pretty much everything else in his book completely unconvincing. As I hope I've demonstrated a number of times in this episode, so much of Hancock's hypothesis is based on a type of stream of consciousness logic. It flows like this. On Pillar 43, there is a vulture. You know who else were sometimes described as bird-like? The Watchers from the Book of Enoch. Those guys were described as semi-divine teachers of civilization. So therefore, the vulture on Pillar 43 could maybe represent a semi-divine teacher of civilization. Therefore, the vulture on the pillar means the magicians of the gods were real. Whew. This, my friends, is what we call a logical fallacy. It sounds like logic, it's arranged like logic, but the premises do not necessarily support the conclusion. But in a way, this is Hancock's great gift. He overwhelms his readers with arguments such as these. He gives you so much data to pick through that finding every soft piece of logic and every unsupported leap can become exhausting. His writing has a way of making you submit to it. If you weren't reading Magicians of the Gods incredibly critically, the sheer mass of data he pours on you might just convince you that he's right, or at least onto something. You can easily get lost trying to unpack complex arguments about the processions of the stars before you realize that none of it matters if his central claim that a vulture carving is meant to represent a constellation is false. Altogether, there's no hard evidence that Hancock's Atlantis-like global civilization existed. Now, there are certainly gaps in our understanding where perhaps a lost civilization might be hiding. But everything he presents as positive evidence of this culture is deeply speculative. And honestly, not that compelling. The saddest thing about it is that Magicians of the Gods isn't even that fun to read. I mean, it's boring. Don't read it. I mean, of course, you can do whatever you want. I don't want to, you know, be the thought police here. I don't think you will be harmed by engaging with Hancock's ideas, but just get ready for a slog. It's too bad, because a super advanced lost civilization is such a cool idea. I understand why people like it. But in this case, it doesn't seem to matter how much I fuss with my decoder ring. Some things just don't make sense. Okay, that's all for this week's episode. Thanks again for joining us. Now, normally, I would say join us again in 2 weeks' time when we'll explore another historical myth. But it's the holiday season, and so that means you're going to have to wait twice as long to get your next episode of Our Fake History. The next free episode of Our Fake History is going to be coming out on January 15th of 2019. Now, if you're dying to get some more Our Fake History in the meantime, you can always join up on Patreon. That's patreon.com/ourfakehistory. And get the brand new extra episode that will be dropping earlier in the new year. So once I'm off on my break, I'm going to be putting together that brand new extra episode, and that will tide over all of my Patreon subscribers until the next free episode comes out on January the 15th. So if you find yourself over the holiday feeling a little deprived of your Our Fake History, go to Patreon. Sign up, support the show, get all the extras. There's now a pretty sizable collection of extra episodes for people supporting at the $3 or more level. So maybe that's what you're doing this holiday season. Now, speaking of Patreon, I need to give some very special shout-outs. This week, I would like to thank William Galindo, Bhargavi Vaidyar, Daniel Hernandez, Gerardo Cerati, James Daniel Little, John Oatley, Vincent Minucci, Jonathan Raphaelson, Eric Johnson, Christopher Seeley, Tyler O'Brien, Josh Milliner, Robert Mikado, and, ooh, this one's going to be tough, Asa Maria H. Guomundsdottir. All of you have decided to support the podcast at the $5 or more level. So you know what that means. You are beautiful human beings. Now, while I am off for the next 4 weeks, you may want to get in touch with me. You can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory, or you can go to the Facebook group. That's facebook.com/ourfakehistory, and you can see what I'm posting there. I'm going to have a bunch of pictures up of Göbekli Tepe this week. Also, head to the website. That's ourfakehistory.com. Look at the pages that I put up for all of the episodes and check out Frank Fiorentino's work. For everyone out there celebrating Hanukkah, happy Hanukkah. For everyone out there celebrating Christmas, Merry Christmas. To anyone out there celebrating anything else, hey, here's Festivus for the rest of us. You all rule. I hope you have a safe, healthy, and fun holiday season. To all my Patreon people, be watching your feed in the next few weeks for a new episode on the Knights Templar. And for everyone else, I'll catch you in January of 2019. All right. As always, the theme music on the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.